Senator Olson, Senate File 3067. Secretary Ritchie is joining you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very pleased to be here today on behalf of Senate File 3067. This is a bill which allows the Office of the Secretary of State to waive the reinstatement fee for any business owner who is unable to maintain a current status due to combat or employment outside the U.S. related to national defense. The cost of doing this service for our veterans is, it does have a fiscal note. The fiscal note is just a little over $900. So it's for a very small cost. We can do something, I think, meaningful and significant for veterans who were not able to maintain their current status simply because they're off serving our country. And so I want to thank Secretary Ritchie for bringing this bill to me and allowing me to carry it on his behalf, and I'd like to give him the opportunity to testify at this point.
Secretary Ritchie, welcome to the committee.
Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for taking this up in such a timely manner. We sometimes have the terrible duty of informing a soldier or a contractor who's come back from the Middle East that their business has been dissolved or their status has been revoked because they didn't get the paperwork in on time. And so this gives us that opportunity to be flexible and to be responsive in a way that's very meaningful, doesn't affect a ton of people, so it doesn't affect the general budget very much, but it's very important to those folks who have so many other things to do, to handle, to deal with when they come back. So we appreciate Senator Olson carrying this bill and your consideration of it today, and be happy to answer any questions anyone might have. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, and seems like a minimal cost that we should be able to handle, and certainly a worthy goal. Questions, members? Senator Erickson Ropes, would you say again?
The effective date is.
Move the bill? Oh, yes. I think.
Senator Olson just brought to my attention that we might need to change the effective date.
Yeah. What's wrong with going back?
Is that okay?
Retroactively.
Retroactive? Is that okay? Everything okay with that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe that this is the way that it was intended to be. There was some, I think there was a technical amendment that was underway with respect to this bill, but I don't think it's been completed yet. I don't have it available at this point. So,
Senator Olson, what does the amendment pertain to?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, two primary things and then a third small item. On page 1, line 7, deleting the word business entity and inserting business or nonprofit corporation, limited liability company, cooperative, limited partnership, or limited liability partnership. The purpose there is to really define specifically the kinds of incorporations or filings that our office would normally be handling, to be specific. The second, again, page 1, line 7, after dissolved, insert the words revoked or terminated. Those are the specific terms that we use in our office. And then on page 1.
Mr. Ritchie,
yes.
What I'm thinking is these really are more judiciary issues. You're going to go to the Judiciary Committee
yes.
with this. It doesn't really deal with the veterans' policy portion of this. So why don't we hold and we'll let you fix that up between committee. But before we do that, let the record show that we have a quorum. So with that, members, are you comfortable letting them make that change between here and the Judiciary Committee? Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate File number 3067 be recommended to pass and referred to the Judiciary Committee. Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is referred.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Dill. Senate File 2878, Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 2878 is a bill that is brought forward by the Board of Veterinary Medicine, which is a regulatory board for those of us that are licensed veterinarians. Last year, we had this same bill in front of you, which at that time included a small provision that dealt with equine dentistry. And that provision is not in this bill. So I'm going to have Dr. King, who's the executive director for the Board of Veterinary Medicine, explain what is in this bill, and then I have Dr. Tom Haggard here from the Board of from the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association to provide some additional comments. But since this is the board's bill and Dr. King understands it very well, I'll have him provide the bill presentation.
Dr. King.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. John King. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. This bill presented by Senator Dill, there's a fact sheet available. I'm happy to say has no fiscal note and is non-controversial to the best of my knowledge. The first item would accept an alternative program for the evaluation of the educational equivalency of a foreign-trained veterinarian. Right now, there's one pathway. This would give another comparable pathway for the evaluation of their educational equivalency. It's accepted in 25 states and U.S. territories. The University of Minnesota Veterinary School currently has about 20 individuals a year going through their program that are foreign-trained graduates. They complete their fourth year of veterinary college at the University of Minnesota, and this would apply directly to them. Next thing would be addressing the faculty licensure requirements for veterinarians, clinical veterinarians, working at the University of Minnesota Veterinary Teaching Hospital. These are going to expand the applicant pool to have European board certified individuals as well as American board certified individuals that would be eligible for a specialty licensure and work on the animals owned by the public. Third thing would be eliminating the requirement for the board to service orders by certified U.S. mail and would allow them to be served by regular U.S. mail. The veterinary board and other boards have run into problems that when a board order is served by certified mail, the recipient just simply chooses not to sign for it. Therefore, the order is not served and is not in effect. This would allow 3 days after it is sent to the last known address of the individual that the order would be in effect. It also continues to allow for personal service by a law enforcement individual as well. And the last item would modify and clarify language in the Veterinary Practice Act that addresses prescription items. The changes are technical in nature and would help them be consistent with the Board of Pharmacy language regarding provider dispenser and also be compliant with FDA rules and regs. I have nothing more. I'm happy to answer any questions if there is any.
Thank you, Dr. King. Dr. Haggerty.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Haggerty. I'm a veterinarian. I'm representing the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. The association has had numerous discussions on this bill over the last 2-3 years to be sure that the members of the association feel comfortable with it. And it, now in this particular form, the veterinarians of the state of Minnesota are comfortable and do think this is an important bill, important to get this taken care of.
Senator Dill or maybe Dr. King, what's the fiscal impact of this? Because I understand you're going to be expanding the scope of this. Is there a fiscal impact to this?
There's no fiscal note. There's no fiscal cost regarding this bill.
But there's more revenue coming in.
Senate Counsel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Mueller wanted to point out that if you have new licensees, there's going to be additional people paying for licensure, and there may not be an additional cost, but there may be additional revenue and how that all works. But
the
Dr. King.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is not necessarily going to create additional licensees. It's a different pathway for the evaluation of their equivalency, of their educational equivalency. The increase in licensees in the state would be is undetermined, but it would be very small.
Mr. Mueller, do you have some comments on this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did talk to the fiscal analysts before the hearing for the Health and Human Services Committee, and they, and I don't know if they talked directly with you, but they thought they probably would want to see this. And I don't know the way this could go, if maybe a fiscal note can be requested and then referred at some point and it just, you know, held off on final passage on the floor or something and then be referred or sent to finance. And then if there's no fiscal implication, they could always just forward it up onto the floor.
Yeah. Senator Dill, would that be an okay path for you to take with this bill if we send this to finance, request a fiscal impact note? If there is none, they'll refer it to the floor. Otherwise, it would go to the appropriate fiscal committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's fine. I guess I would prefer having it go to the floor because I think Dr. King is right. There's hardly any fiscal impact here because it's just another way of providing licensing in a little more efficient way than we're currently using. But if the committee would feel more comfortable doing it that way, going to finance, so that's fine too.
Senator Kubler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dale. I guess, you know, I'm wondering what on page 7, you know, lines 7.7 and 7.11, you've got, you know, the use of over-the-counter drugs for extra-label use by a client. I mean, why would we want to expand, you know, a person's scope of practice to include over-the-counter drugs?
Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of Senator Kubley, the label is the law. And there are some products that work in veterinary medicine, but when you buy them or where they're available in a human pharmacy for over-the-counter use or, say, in a grocery store for over-the-counter use, you cannot legally use those drugs on an animal in a way that's different than what the label says unless you have a prescription from a veterinarian to do so. And that's true for prescription, any veterinary prescription drugs, human prescription drugs. There's so many animals out there that there's not a set of drugs that have been approved for use on those animals that we have this system of extra label use of these drugs that can only be used on the prescription of a veterinarian because there's nothing else available. And based on the veterinarian's experience and so forth, he can use these drugs to solve the problems that he's presented with. And a good example is when you go to the zoo, those animals are so rare that there's practically no drugs approved for use in zebras or gorillas and polar bears and so forth, but they still have to be treated. So, and when you look at the broad range of drugs that are available, there's a veterinary over-the-counter drugs, veterinary prescription drugs, human drugs that are prescription and over-the-counter drugs, and they're all available for extra label use, providing the veterinarian has a veterinarian client-patient relationship with the animal and the client. And in his best judgment, the only option available is to use an extra label drug.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dale. I guess, you know, if this hasn't been a problem up to now, I mean, what's the source of, you know, trying to include over-the-counter drugs? I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me that part of my problem, I suppose, is that I don't place animals that are owned by a person in the same category as other people who live in their household. And I guess I'd like to give, the owner of the animal a little more latitude than you would like to do by what this bill would require. you know, it just seems to me that over-the-counter drugs are kind of at the option of the owner. I don't know, as we need a veterinarian to tell us. You know, I think most people are interested in the welfare of their animal. They're not interested in medicating it for something that they don't know what the outcome would be, and I'm not sure that this is a good step or not. I guess it's just
requiring a veterinary.
Well, Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think all of us can agree that we should follow the label directions, and that's what we should usually do, except in rare exceptions. And I would like to have Dr. King or Dr. Hagerty contribute to the answer to this question.
Well, and Senator Dill or Dr. King, when you're answering, so what this is doing is if somebody gives their dog an aspirin occasionally, would that be something about what you're talking about here, Dr. King?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, that would not be. Over-the-counter drugs in veterinary medicine are those drugs that are available in the feed mill or in places that are not do not require a prescription. Penicillin, some tetracyclines, some sulfas, drugs that are most common violation in food animals as far as residues. To use a drug in any other manner other than what is labeled is against USDA or FDA law. That means penicillin that you can pick up in the feed mill. Its label says 1 cc per 100 pounds for use of foot rot. If that owner decides to use it at twice the dose in a different route other than indicated for another disease, that individual is violating federal law. This would continue to allow the extra label use of these drugs as prescribed by a veterinarian.
Senator Sodbeer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
Would this also apply to pet vaccinations?
Mr. Chair.
Dr. King.
Pet vaccinations, modified live vaccines are considered prescription item. Those are under the rules of the Board of Animal Health, not the Board of Veterinary Medicine. So that's outside the jurisdiction and scope of the Board of Veterinary Medicine.
Mr. Chair, could you say that? Could you
Senator
say that
Chaudhry.
Again?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I think you're getting at distemper vaccines for cats and dogs. Is that correct? Those are regulated by the Board of Animal Health in their rules. And that's not within the Board of Veterinary Medicine. Those are not necessarily used extra label. They're considered a prescription item in Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
If the owner of a dog kennel regularly ordered and administered vaccines to their to puppies that they were raising, would they, under this new rule, now have to do it under the supervision of a veterinarian?
Dr. King.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, it would have absolutely no change on their ability to do so. They had to acquire those vaccines legally through a veterinarian. It has nothing to do with the under direct supervision of that veterinarian. And it would not be in an extra label use fashion because those vaccines are labeled for use in those animals.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. King. It just seems to me that lines 7.10 through 7.12 would greatly increase the cost of care for an animal, you know, something that you did not previously require a veterinarian to monitor must now be monitored. A veterinarian must monitor the use of over-the-counter drugs for extra-label use. I don't think that ought to be in there. So I think we ought to take it out.
Dr. King.
Senator Kubley, they're deleting that the veterinarian has to oversee the extra-label use of a veterinary drug directly by the client. So the similar language would be in there. This language was put in there so it's consistent with Board of Pharmacy with regard to provider dispenser language. Ultimately, the veterinarian, if they're prescribing or having the producer use a drug in an extra label fashion, that veterinarian is responsible. Now, if the producer goes and does it on their own accord, the veterinarian is not responsible. It does not require that the animal is examined each time.
Senator Dell.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think what Dr. King has said is this is already part of federal law, and it makes it consistent with what we've got in other parts of state law. And frankly, I've just been I think we're lucky that we can even do extra label use of drugs at all, because the label should be the law, which it is. You're not free to apply these different chemicals and drugs in a way that's different than what the label says. The label is the law. But there are situations that you're faced with where you've got a sick animal and there's no other drug available that has a chance of working, and you need to do something. And so rather than give everybody the freedom to do extra label use of drugs, the veterinarian is the one that's given that authority, because he's had more experience and is trained to try to make these kinds of decisions. So, and I'd like to ask Dr. King if he has any further comments, or Dr. Haggerty, because if I have said something that's not quite right, I want that corrected. But I think as policymakers, extra label use of drugs is illegal and should be, but in the judgment of the veterinarian under special circumstances, we should be able to continue to do what has been practiced and is currently legal, and that's use the extra label use of drugs for special situations. That means increasing the dosage. It means using drugs that in animals where there's no other drug available because they're minor species. And I'm a sheep producer, for example. There's anthelmintics we use that are approved for use in cattle but not sheep, because they're kind of a minor breed, and through our own experience we know it works.
Well, members, while you ponder this, do you have anybody else to testify, Senator Dale?
No.
Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify in opposition to Senate File 2878? Any other questions or discussion, members?
Well,
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dale. I mean, when you say human drugs, I mean, in the first part, you say the prescribing veterinarian must monitor the use of veterinary prescription drugs. So, but then you say human drugs for extra label use. So is that any human drug, including over-the-counter, or is that human prescription drugs?
Dr. King or Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, it says human drugs, and there are human drugs that are used in veterinary medicine for various things, and again, they should be used according to the label, but occasionally we have to use them in an extra label fashion.
Well, Mr. Senator Chair and Senator Dill, it seems to me that again, you know, I mean, you're bringing into question whether an animal owner has the best interests of their animal in mind. And I think that, you know, certainly people who are raising animals for part of their income are going to want what is best for those animals. So, you know, I mean, I just don't think they should have to pay a veterinary fee in order to issue, you know, to use drugs that are sold over the counter, whether it be for humans or for animal use, if they want to use them according to the label. You know, I don't see where that would be a problem. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make an amendment on line 7.6. I'd like to add in the new language, between the word human and drugs, I'd like to add the word prescription. And after the word use, I would omit everything following the word use down to line 7.7, where it also says the word use, and include that in the omission. And then I would do the same thing on line 7.11 and 7.12. So it would read, the prescribing veterinarian must monitor the use of veterinary prescription drugs, human prescription drugs for extra label use, or human prescription drugs for extra label use by a client. And I would omit over-the-counter drugs for extra label use and insert the word prescription and the word or after the word drugs on line 7.11.
Well, Senator Kubley moves an oral amendment. Did Mr. Bodern, did you get that?
Mr. Chairman, we're going to need to do that again, I think, unless Mr. Knapp captured it.
Well, why don't you guys work on that just for a minute? I have a question of Senator Kubley. Senator Kubley, the way I read this on line 7.7 is primarily the objection point that you're having. But when the extra label use of an over-counter drug, they're going off-label, and that's why the veterinary needs to be involved. They're not using an over-the-counter drug as it is intended to be used. They're using it extra label, off labels, and that's why the veterinary needs to be involved. That's my understanding of what Dr. King and Senator Dill are talking about. And so I don't know that we want to have people using over-the-counter drugs, not according to the label that's on the package, without somebody, a veterinarian, overseeing that use, because it's off-label, which is illegal, in my understanding. Senator Dill?
Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you a little story. The second to the last time I got my hair cut, I was coughing, and my barber said, I got a solution for you. I got a bottle of vitamins here that I'll sell you, which you're supposed to only take one vitamin a day, but I recommend you take 24 a day. Six pills every 4 hours. That'll be right. Well, anyway, it was 24 a day, 24 times the recommended dosage. And I thought to myself, does this barber have the right to practice medicine on me? And what does this guy know about it? He's tried it on himself, and it seemed to work. And I just don't think I want my barber doing that. But if it was a physician that was doing it, who had some experience and training and knowledge and tried it in some other people first, I might think about it. But it's the same thing with these animals. You want somebody that's accustomed to treating animals and has a lot of experience using various drugs, and it's not something that anybody should be doing.
Well, members, we've got the Kubley Amendment. Do we have that in order? Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, I check with Senator Kubley to make sure. It would be on page 7, line 6, after human insert prescription. Oh, and also, I'm sorry, on 7.6, between drugs and human, delete the common insert or. And then delete everything after use on line 6. Delete everything before by on line 7. And on 7.11, again, delete the comma between drugs and human and insert or. And after human, before drugs, insert prescription. And then delete everything on that line after the word use. And then on line 7.12, delete everything before the word by.
Is that correct, Senator Kubley?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And I guess, again, you know, I personally think that it will escalate the cost of caring for animals. And again, I don't think that, I really don't think that most people are not going to be using drugs on their animals that they're trying to raise for an income by endangering their health in any way. So I don't see a reason to add these kinds of issues to the cost of raising those animals at this point. I mean, it's been okay up to this point, so I really don't see why we need that.
Senator Chaudhry, were you to the amendment?
Yeah.
Senator Chaudhry.
Just a question, Senator Kubley. Does the words by a client impact this at all, where you would have an existing relationship, that this applies to an existing relationship as opposed to what the chair described as me giving an aspirin to my dog. I'm not a client of a veterinarian, so therefore this rule wouldn't apply. Is this just confining it to situations where there is a client veterinarian relationship, and it's putting an additional burden on the veterinarian to do so, to monitor various activities? Interpretation as well?
Senator Kubley.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Chaudhry. I guess from my perspective, you know, I don't perceive a problem with anyone who owns an animal, buying over-the-counter drugs to treat that animal for any problem that's been encountered. I mean, it's just going to add the cost of hiring a veterinarian to do some things that were normally done by the owner of the animal. I think, most people that have animals are going to treat them in a way that will hopefully help them recover, or, I think they're concerned about their safety, they're concerned about their health, and I just don't see a reason to put another cost on them. I do think that, when you have a family pet, you tend to take those to a veterinarian anyway, but, I just see this as another layer, I guess, of bureaucracy that is going to add cost to the ownership and treatment of animals that an individual might own. So I don't know, whether that relationship with a veterinarian is there or not is kind of a moot point, in my opinion. I think if you want to buy an over-the-counter drug, that should be your prerogative. It's not like treating your kids. It's treating an animal.
Senator Laurie, to the amendment.
To the amendment, I've got a couple of questions, I guess. First, if we're going to do the amendment, we should probably clean up Section 14 on the next page as well.
Mr. Knopf was just bringing that to my attention.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Laurie.
But then also, to Senator Kubley's point, and maybe a question for Senator Dill and the testifiers, what is the need we're responding to here? Has there been problems in the current treatment of animals that have been brought to people's attention? What is the need that the public policy need we're trying to address with this provision?
Dr. King.
Mr. Chair, Senator Laurie, there's two things that need to be kept in mind when the veterinary medicine and it applies to both food animals and to companion animals. With the accountability factor with regard to food animals, that there needs to be an accountability to make sure that the food chain and the food entering the food chain is safe and effective and there are no volatile residues. To eliminate the extra label use of these drugs would mean that when the producer did use those drugs in a way other than what's on the label, they would be violating federal law. So it's two-pronged. It has the accountability that if drugs are being used beyond the label, that there is a veterinarian involved. That does not mean that animal is examined each time. There's no – a veterinary client-patient relationship is established by way of an exam or familiarity with the herd and the way the animals are kept. So it does not require that animal be examined each and every time that extra-label use of drugs are used.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. King, so how long has that been in federal law, and who was the instigator of putting it there? Was it the veterinarian folks, or was it actually brought by people who raise and treat animals that they don't feel they need a veterinarian for?
Dr. King.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, that's in AMDUCA, which is it's a federal acronym of which I can't recall what it specifically means, but it addresses the use of drugs in food-producing animals, and that there's an obligation to use approved drugs first, and that if there is an extra-label use of a drug, that it requires a veterinarian's involvement in some way to ensure that they're being used appropriately and to not contaminate or jeopardize the food supply. And that's been there for many years in Amduka.
Members, we're going to start wrapping this one up here shortly. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I would appreciate it if you'd vote no on this amendment. I can't believe that this committee would really like to start authorizing the use of extra-labeled drugs in our food-producing animals. You need to have an experienced person that's making that decision and just making some decision on what kind of withdrawal time is necessary, and it just is not appropriate to start encouraging or even talking about letting any Tom, Dick, and Harry out there start using extra-label use drugs on the food-producing animals.
Senator Kubley, you renew your motion?
I'll withdraw the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley withdraws the oral amendment. Any more discussion? Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On the front page, just a curiosity. My dad was a veterinarian in India. He arrived in the U.S. in 1966. And I've never asked him this, so I thought I'd ask you based on the dates of the requirement. Did he have to take the ECFVG exam or get that certificate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, the ECFVG is the current program that evaluates foreign equivalency. That did not go into effect until in the 70s, I believe. So prior to that, there was not necessarily, that I know of, a way of evaluating equivalency of foreign trained graduates.
Thank you.
Any more debate? Senator Dill, do you have a motion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know whether you do you want this sent to finance, or what is your thinking on this right now?
Well, Senator Dill, I really think it would be better if we sent it to finance to see if there is any revenue impacts. And if there are none, they'll forward it to the floor. And if there are some, they'll have to refer it to the appropriate committee. There is a question about adding people to this, so we're going to need to address that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Board of Veterinary Medicine is probably going to have to raise the licensing fee for veterinarians anyway, just because of different things that have happened the last year or two. So if anything happens here, there might be just a slight increase in income, and I don't see that there'll be much cost, if any. But at any rate, I'll do as a committee request or as a committee chair request, and that is I will move the Senate File 2878. Be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Senator Dill, for agreeing to moving it. We do need to track whatever's going on there. Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The bill is referred to Finance. Thank you, Senator Dill.
Yeah, thank you.
Senator Erickson Ropes, Senate File 2994. Senator.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here this afternoon with a bill that's familiar to you. It's new to me, but it's familiar to some of you. And before I begin, I just want to remind the committee that one of the things that I think is most important as we write bills together and come up with solutions here on the Senate side is that we put a strong emphasis on working together, and I really am very committed to bills that I carry, that I bring all the stakeholders together as much as possible. I try to work out consensus language, and I try to be a bridge builder between ideas. And I joke a little bit. I don't know if I've told you this, but I've been married to a Republican for about 30 years, so I know how to get along. And, you know, the part of life is, chalking up your ideas and then listening to other ideas and then trying to find something in the middle that's going to work. So I feel like that's the direction we're heading with this pesticide application bill. And I am the first generation off the farm in my family. I have a 900-plus year history that goes way back to a couple of farmsteads in Norway of coming from a long farming family. My mom was raised on a farm, so as I was growing up, I'd go back to the grandparents' farm. I have same-age cousins who are dairy farmers. I grew up walking the bean rows, picking cocklebur and lamb's quarters, so I have a real special place in my heart for farming, and I do not see this as an anti-farmer bill. I know some people are really upset about that. The direction I'm looking at this bill from is from a health perspective. There have been reports of people that have had health reactions to some of the pesticide applications. So when this bill was presented to me, I'm just very interested in supporting the notion that the public has a right to know pieces of information that impact their health. And I have a Coke bottle or a Diet Dr. Pepper bottle, actually, sitting at my seat there. And on the side of that, I can read the label. And it tells me all sorts of probably not good things that's in there, but I drink it anyway. And this falls along the same lines, in my opinion. The public has a right to know information that is going to be potentially affecting their health. And then if they look at that information and say, okay, I'm not disturbed by this, I'm going to go on with my life, or in the case of pesticide applications, if we can understand when there's going to be a spray schedule, I can decide to shut my windows or go visit my sister for a couple days, or move the herd to the other side of the pasture, or whatever. And when this bill first came to me, actually, there was a lot of ideas about it being very restrictive, in that there was some discussion about wanting to have applicators mail individual letters to their neighbors around the perimeter of an application area, telling them an exact date about when they were going to be spraying. And, I just think that's not realistic. It's much more realistic, and I've been working with Bruce Clavin, who's the lobbyist, as many of you know, for some of the commodity groups. And we've been having really good discussions about how to make this a reasonable and moderate and sensible bill for both the public and the applicators. And I hope he'll testify in a little bit, too, that we have been working together, and I think we have a pretty cooperative relationship. And but we're still in the midst of discussion on getting to consensus on all items. I think there's many, many things we agree on. And we'll be talking specifically about a couple that we're still working on. So I just wanted to give you that little bit of an introduction to frame where we're going on this. And with this, I think I will start with my delete all amendment. And I think you have that before you. Do you have the A3 amendment, or has that been passed out?
Senator will pass the A3 amendment out.
Okay. So that puts...
Senator, why don't you start walking us through the A3 amendment while it's getting passed
okay.
out?
Okay. We'll thank you. Just to again let members know... I have been working with Mr. Clavin on language, and I started out with quite a long bill, and then in working with Mr. Clavin, accepted his base language, which reduced it to just probably about a paragraph or so. And we've been using that language to move forward. And that's the A3 amendment that you will see in front of you. What we're suggesting here is a timeline where the commissioner would work with the University of Minnesota Extension Service, because this group has indicated that they have the capacity and interest in being able to establish a website. It'll probably would be Well, it would be a public website, perhaps on the Department of Ag's website, where individual citizens could go and plug in a location, either their address or their zip code number or whatever sort of location information, and bring up, then you'll see a list here of seven items. And they would be able to see a list of crops that are grown in Minnesota and the counties which each of those crops are grown in. And then instead of a date certain for individual applications, we have come to consensus on listing a range of application dates. The beginning and end date for each application, for each pesticide by crop. And then also a statement saying that due to unforeseen outbreaks of either disease or pests, there may be some off-schedule application that is needed or emergency application that's needed. And then if that emergency application occurs, then they need to post that information. And then also a toll-free number, and I think this is sort of a routine feature of some of the other pesticide initiatives. And then item 7, which is a monthly posting of pesticide records. Now, there's a couple points that we're still working on here, and one of them is item 7. And Mr. Cleveland and I still need to have continuing conversation about how that is going to play out. And then the mechanism by which the public would be able to check on information like this. For example, right now, if you don't know who your legislator is, well, you're in trouble. But if one of your citizens don't know who their senator is, for example, they could go to the legislator website and type in your zip code, and that brings up your legislator's name. Mr. Clavin and I have talked about possibly using a zip code as a mechanism to get you the local information you're looking for. So with that just as a frame of what we're putting out there, I do have a couple witnesses who'd like to tell their story.
Senator, yes. Senator, this is your first committee stop, so this is A3 will be an author's amendment. And
yes.
Senator Erickson-Ropes moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A3 is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To the
Chair.
Witnesses, okay. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
All right. We have two witnesses with us here today, and they have stories about health impacts and why they're interested in this website. So if you would introduce yourself to the committee, and then you can tell them your story.
Chair, Senators. My name is Rebecca Sheets, and I come from Staples.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Sheets.
It's not easy to be here. We are small family farmers in the Staples area. And for over the past 20-some years, I've worked with the University of Minnesota, the researchers in the system. And just a little background here. I served on the Board of Irrigators Association for the state of Minnesota. Yeah, I worked with the Ag Conservation Stabilization Service, and I volunteered on MDA, Department of Ag, water quality projects in the local area where I come from. I'm also a certified master gardener and a home food prep consultant. And I did all these things because I care about farming and our future generations. And I believe in a positive change for our future. And I worked with research on different classes of pesticides to help my neighbors, the farmers, in my part, to help feed the world. We researched insecticides for potatoes, edible beans, fungicides on these same crops. We studied herbicides for weed control and worked with alternative crops for central Minnesota. And I, too, grew up walking beans and baling hay and all of these things. Over the years, when I questioned the safety, I was told they were safe. No one was wearing any protective gear. They would have told me if it was needed. And now I am chemically sensitive to all these different classes of pesticides. And I sustained a pesticide poisoning on the job in 1993, which has obviously made this a lot worse. And I was hit by an aerial application of two fungicides and insecticide when I was working in a field that was posted had been sprayed about 4 days before. And I was told pesticides don't hurt people. When we bought our farm in the early 80s, it was all small family farms and good rotational systems. Now we have an intensive potato production area, and they tend to spray just about every day in our area on the potatoes, starting maybe on a Monday and working its way back around in 5 or 6 days to hit the same fields. In the beginning, it wasn't too bad. It was maybe once or twice a year with the fungicides and insecticides, and that's not the case anymore. I did work at a research station, and under my care was a lot of children and elderly people. And when I complained, it got very difficult, and I'm no longer employed there. So I left the job to spend more time at home. I have a disabled husband with progressive Parkinson's disease, and to avoid more exposures. We keep being exposed to drift in our home and in our yard. This last summer, or last spring, the applicator who I had previously talked to, the company, and told them we were chemically sensitive, sprayed in a 17-mile-an-hour wind. And there was no rain, and it volatilized in our air for 6 weeks. We could smell it. I've asked these applicators not to spray when it's windy. And I'm not good at this. But we were hit with a combination of two herbicides and a tank mix. And we were ill all summer. And these effects stay. They don't just go away. And my organic sows, we worked for 10 years to build up our organic herd. And most of them aborted their fetuses within 3 weeks of the application. So we're out of business, no. What do I do with these pigs? Do I sell them into the food chain? Because I've been direct selling to customers? I can't in good conscience do that. I can tell when the spraying is happening from miles away when it's windy because I can't breathe. My lips go numb. I can tell what class of pesticide is being sprayed. I started talking to other people in our area who are having similar problems. Going in the house and closing the doors for us is not an option because it permeates everything. And I have brought today pictures of the foliage in our gardens that died from this last summer's application. We need this pesticide right to know. Other people can maybe just leave the area for a day or two. But when it's on everything in our home, our little farm, we can't leave long enough because we can't afford to do that. My husband was exposed to Agent Orange and other solvents when he was in the Vietnam era vet, and he's 61 and he's ill. I'm just here to make it very clear, drift is happening in our area all the time. I see little kids being exposed when I go down the road. They sit underneath the spray mist. I see them riding their bikes through it. And they stop. They stop to watch the planes and things because it's interesting. Our cars get sticky going down the roads because we're coated. Our children playing in our yards. Our animals in the pasture are getting sick. The gardens I grow by choice without pesticides are drifted on. And I can this food. My Amish friends and their families are drifted on when they're going down the road in their buggies. And this isn't about just me, because I'm pretty sure what's going to happen. This is about my grandchildren and your grandchildren. And I think there is enough research to say we need to be safer about this. We need this right to know. And all we're asking is, we need to know what chemicals to protect ourselves from and what we can do after we're affected. I have more, but that's about enough for me.
Thank you, Ms. Sheets.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Sheets, I just want to thank you for coming in. It's obviously hard for her to give her testimony. I hear two different issues going on here. One is drift, and I think we have some pretty strict drift laws already on the books. So we have a compliance issue that's separate from this bill that you know
it's kind of illegal.
Should be able to get some people to help you with, because we're very strict about drift regulations. But her second point is she does believe she has the right to know what it is that's being applicated or applied. Thank you very much. And our next witness, would you introduce yourself to the committee, please?
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Norma Smith. My husband Don and I and our family moved to a small farm by Frazee in Otter Tail County in 1976. In 1977, we started raising sheep, building the flock up to about 60 head. Don worked out, so it was my job to take care of them. Our two youngest boys helped with chores and showed sheep in 4-H, receiving blue ribbons and an occasional purple. For many years, our vacation was going to the Minnesota State Fair to show sheep. For 18 years, we continued to raise sheep. In 1995, potatoes were planted just across the swamp from our pasture. That summer, an airplane sprayed every Saturday morning at 5:30, the same time the sheep were out grazing. The next spring of 1996, when lambing time came, there were no lambs. Our only lambs came from 6 ewe lambs we fed at the barn. Most of the ewes lambed the spring of 1997, but some of the lambs were not okay. That winter, one by one, they started to die until half the flock was gone. Don opened one up to find the liver discolored, not dark red, but a tannish color. Twice that first summer, we found hundreds of dead birds laying under the power lines. All this happening to us, I thought someone would surely want to know. I called the DNR, the Ag Department, anyone I thought would care. Finally, someone at the Ag Department answered the phone, and I told her our problem. I was told it had to be weighed out, and that $1 million potato crop was worth a whole lot more than our little herd of sheep. But those sheep made our farm payment. The summer of 1998, I was out raking hay in our field. They were spraying about a mile away with the wind blowing very strong. The next day, I lost my voice for 3 days. Last year was our 12th season to be affected. How has this affected us? If we stay outside while spraying, we both get a headache, sore throats, or else we just feel yucky. So we stay inside or we have to leave. Now we have cattle and they don't cycle right either. We have been buying drinking water for 11 years. The Department of Ag tested our water and said it was safe, but we no longer feel comfortable drinking it. We suspected this pesticide problem from the beginning, but now we know that we get drift more than just the day they spray. We tested with a drift catcher the summer of 2006, and the results show that we are contaminated 49 out of 62 days. Last year, the potato field was a mile away. One spray day, the wind was blowing 16 miles per hour. 4 out of 6 times since we've been keeping records, they spray, the wind is out of the south and comes right into our yard. We have grandchildren who come to play. We worry, how does that affect them? Our garden is also affected, and we wonder, is the produce safe? Is it safe to eat our animals? For 12 years, we've been told these sprays are safe, and now we find out how toxic they are, and it makes me so angry that we had to prove it. This past summer, we tested air around a field 1 mile to the east of us. There are 11 families around that field, those potatoes were planted right in their backyards. There is a trailer court up here behind these trees. 150 feet from that field, 8 families live up there. We feel we also have the right to work the ground and raise animals. We choose not to use chemicals in our house, garden, or yard, but chemicals coming off potato fields gives us no choice. We need this legislation so that we can better protect ourselves from pesticides. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Smith.
Thank you, Mrs. Smith. I appreciate that. And we have potato farmers and sheep farmers, I believe, at the table. So they're, you know, I'm sure you have some history in understanding some of this. Again, I would say for you, Mrs. Smith, if the issue is drift, we do have very tight regulations on drift. And maybe some of your local legislators and I should be able to help these folks on their drift issues. But in addition to that, I do think it's critical that these people have an opportunity to go to a public website, be able to type in their location or through some mechanism, and find out what it is that is being applied. It's like it's the same concept as looking on the side of any of our food containers or going to McDonald's, not on the individual boxes, but they have posters there about food content and things like that. The public is becoming very savvy and very interested in wanting to know what it is we're eating and drinking and being exposed to, so they can make choices in their private lives about what cautions to take, whether they want to leave the farm during a spray or application cycle, or if, in the case of Mrs. Smith, she needs to bring her herd into the barn during application days. Or people need some information about any risk that they might be exposing themselves to. These are legal pesticides and legal chemicals that hopefully are being applied legally. And we don't have an effort here to try to be stopping or disrupting the farmer's work. We just believe that the public has the right to know what those things are. So if there are health concerns or health consequences, when they go to see their doctor, they have the name of what it is that they've been breathing or exposed to. There was a woman that I've been hearing about in this context who had a really severe eye reaction, and her eyes got all puffed up and weepy, and they got infected. And the doctor was halted in his efforts to try to take care of her right away because he didn't know what she'd been exposed to. And so we want to make sure people have the information that they need in case they decide to make these personal decisions in their lives. So that's where we are. I don't know if the committee has any questions for the testifiers.
Senator Earl, there was one more testifier listed. Do you want them to come forward now, or should we go to questions? Senator Laurie, do you have a question of these witnesses?
Well, I have a. If we're not done with the testifiers, I can wait. I had a question of Senator Ropes and.
Okay, we'll go to the next testifier.
Yeah, Miss. Senator Chaudhry.
Here we go.
Of the witnesses, please stay, Ms. Sheets and Mrs. Smith. We have a question. Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Sheets and Ms. Smith. Appreciate you coming down this far to testify. It can be kind of intimidating to come to the legislature, so we appreciate your doing so. I guess the question I had in absorbing all this information is, do your neighbors as well share the same concerns? Have there been neighborhood meetings regarding these issues? And
the
what have been the
in
outcomes?
My neighborhood, excuse me.
Ms. Sheets.
The people in our neighborhood are very concerned about this because this has been going on for many years, and we're starting to see a lot more health effects in our area.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. either of the witnesses, would the legislation that we're looking at change your behavior if you had access to that information?
The Senator Scogin, in what manner?
Senator Scogin.
I thought in the opening comments by Senator Erickson Ropes, there was some reference made to leaving for a day, taking the pets inside, changing your behavior in some way. If you knew, if this information was available that's being proposed, would you, if you knew when people were going to spray approximately and what they were going to spray, would your life change?
Senator Scogin, in my instance, we basically know when they're coming to spray. It's every 5 days or 6 days and or seven if they have to go that far. For years, we thought, yes, if we stayed out of it for the day or left, we were okay. But after we did the drift catching in 2006, that's not true. So every time the wind blows from the south, we're getting more of it. So but the thing that would benefit us is that we know what is being sprayed. If I call and ask, what are you spraying today? Oh, it's just, you know, and they don't. And then when my doctor called and asked, what are you spraying? There was a different answer.
Senator Scogin.
You called the applicator, the farmer?
The farm manager.
Ms. Okay. Smith.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rummel?
Okay. Mr. Chair, as Ms. Rummel's coming up, I'll just respond to Senator Scogin's question. We have two witnesses today that have had many years' worth of experience, so I think understanding the application cycle is probably one of the things you just get to know when you're in ag yourself. But there's lots of people out there that don't know what the spray schedule is, and it's those people, too, we're trying to get information to. And we have Sarah Rummel here as our last witness.
Ms. Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I would just like to encourage you to support this bill. We feel it's important that the citizens of Minnesota have access to information so they can make smart, responsible choices to protect their own health. And we are very interested in working to make sure that this bill is a very modest and moderate bill. We just want to make sure folks have access to information.
Thank you, Ms. Rummel. Questions, Senator Lurie?
Yes, first off, I would like to also echo Senator Chaudhry's appreciation for Ms. Sheets and Ms. Smith coming forward and telling their stories. I know that can be difficult at times, and we do appreciate you coming. It does help. And on a particularly an issue that is going to create some controversy here, we understand how difficult that is, and so I thank you for that. I think that the crux of the language before us, though Senator Ropes falls on number seven here, item seven, the monthly posting of the pesticide records, kept in compliance with subdivision two. And I guess I'm just not familiar with what subdivision two is, and so I was just curious, nuts and bolts wise, what we're talking about here, or is that part of the work that you plan to do as this bill continues forward?
Senator Lurie, do you want Mr. Knopf to
maybe
tell
Mr.
You
Knopf
subdivision
could better address
two?
Subdivision two?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, if you look at the original bill, you can see what the existing law is in section two of Senator Erickson Rope's original bill. It's basically the records that are supposed to be kept by commercial and non-commercial applicators. The issue right now, though, is without subdivision two, without changes to subdivision two, those records aren't necessarily sent in to the Department of Agriculture. And but these are the records that have to be kept by the applicator.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Senator Lurie, that is exactly where I'd like to have Bruce Clavin come and join us at the table. We are continuing our conversation about item seven. We agree on all six of the other items, and we've worked out all that language, and I think we're continuing to have some good discussions. We're trying to figure out a way to get information to the public and still be a reasonable thing for the applicators to deal with. So the other piece that we're still continuing to work on is in number three, where it says the dates of the applications by county, we're talking about, you know, some of the counties are gigantic, you know, so it wouldn't make a lot of sense to post by county if you're in a county that, you know, is 300 miles wide. So we're trying to come up with a different mechanism there, and we're talking about that, and we're also talking about number seven. So,
while we move to the opposition, could Mr. Stennis also, is he here? Maybe he could come up also, and we'll turn to Mr. Claven and Mr. Stennis, please. Mr. Claven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I've been a lobbyist here for 14 years. My name, for the record, Bruce Claven. I've been a lobbyist here for 14 years. The groups I'm representing today on this issue are the following: the Minnesota Association of Wheat Growers, the Minnesota Barley Growers, all three of the sugar companies, the Northern Plains Potato Growers, the R.D. Offutt Company, and the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives, which would include commercial applicators. Those are the groups I represent. There are other organizations that are in the room that asked me to list them for the record so we don't have five people coming up. Those groups are the Minnesota Soybean Growers, the Minnesota Corn Growers, the Farm Bureau, Minnesota Agri-Growth Council, and Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. There may be others. And I would also let the members know that the Farmers Union has been in discussions on the across the street. I don't know where they are on the D3 because Tom is, I think, at a national meeting. So just to let you know that they are participating. As Senator Erickson Ropes mentioned at the outset, we have been discussing this issue for about 10 days. I've been talking with other members about it for 6 years. This first came in 2002. It's been carried by various people. There have been various justifications for the release of records. They change by the year. And I wanted to compliment her because the best idea we've had in 6 years has been this concept of a website simply to get education out there, not the records. We haven't gone that far yet, and that's been mentioned on line 19. But the idea of getting some kind of education is why I have been working with her. This DE3 is not an agreement yet. It's a work in progress. Certainly you see that here at the legislature. I haven't taken this back to my members. I don't know if my colleagues are totally on board with it yet, but this is a discussion we had, so I wanted you to know that it's not an agreement yet. Also, there's probably a fiscal cost here, and we discussed that this morning. Given last Thursday's news, even something that cost a dollar is going to be a little bit iffy here, and for the department to go through this. I don't know what the fiscal note for this is. I do know the fiscal note for the bill as drafted was about $1.7 million, I believe. I don't know what it is here, and I don't know if the department has had a chance to put that together. Briefly, members, for the issue of the record keeping, and that's really our central objection and always has been for 6 years. That record keeping requirement, Mr. Knopf read to you in subdivision 2. It goes through the things you have to keep: wind speed and date and time and so forth. I want to refute some of the misnomers out there that this is the Wild West out in the country. You know, the testimony you heard today is really illegal conduct under the state law. That's what you have here. And that is found in 18B.07. And a couple of those I think are worth noting for your consideration. That section covers pesticide use. First sentence is pesticides must be applied in accordance with the product label. Labeling in a manner that will not cause unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. That's the law right now, has been for a long, long time. Prohibited use, subdivision 2. A person may not use, store, handle, distribute an application of pesticides that is, number one, inconsistent with the label. Now, the growers out in the country know that the label is the law. If the label says do not apply whatever the product is, if the wind speed is greater than 10 miles an hour, most growers are not going to do that because it will blow away. It's very expensive, and now it's going to be blown away and possibly cause a drift. If it's 5 miles an hour, you can spray. That would be complying with the law. That would be inconsistent with the label. Number two, and this one I think is important, that endangers humans, damages ag products, food, livestock, fish, or wildlife. Current law, you may not apply if it's going to cause that in a manner that will result in that. And number three, that will cause unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. Current law, 18B07, subdivision 2. The conduct you heard earlier was illegal. And that's our current law. Finally, under that section, subdivision 2B, a person may not direct a pesticide onto property beyond the boundaries of the target site. Current law. person may not apply a pesticide resulting in damage to adjacent property. Senator Erickson Ropes mentioned, and Mr. Knopf confirmed, we have strict laws on that. And so what you heard before is the law. That doesn't fit the record-keeping disclosure, however. The current law would take care of that in our view. Second point, there seems to be some confusion over the 6 years we've dealt with this as to who gets these records and what they're all about. The USDA, and I just had this in my folder, I have a huge accordion over 6 years of this. This was March 2003. This is the USDA Pesticide Record Keeping Inspection Program. They do random audits, and the department administers that here locally. The purpose is to provide the applicator with educational tools to maintain the records that they need to by law, and number two, to provide assistance during a record-keeping inspection to ensure compliance with the regulation. The purpose of these records in the first place is much like the IRS. You keep your records and your bank statements and all your financial information in your home in case there's an audit, in case there's a problem with the feds. That's why you keep them. You don't send all of your bank statements and your whole stuff into Washington, D.C. You keep them in case there's an audit. That's what the purpose of these are for, is for an investigation. It's not to be made public data. Third, I would also want to refute the idea that the Department of Ag is not doing anything. We have heard this in past committees over the years. I have here a case that I settled in 2004, and this was not me calling the department. This was the farmer. The crops didn't look right after they were sprayed in June. I think it was corn, if I remember right. This was in 2004. He called the department. The department came out. I don't have a name here, but the department came out, took samples, and they discovered that it was Roundup left in the tank, and it was contaminated fertilizer that was applied to the corn. So using the department data that said it was glyphosate contamination, and this was dated September 14, 2004, we settled the case with the insurer of the commercial applicator using the department's data because they did an investigation. So when my client called the department, they came out, did an investigation, and we used the information right here. I blacked it out because it's confidential. Settled the case. So I would refute that notion that the department is not doing anything. I would also make this point to the members. A lot of you represent rural areas, and a lot of you farm here at the table. And I think good communication is something that's lacking here in some of these areas of the state, according to the testimony. Good communication can go a long way. I know at my dad's farm, and he farms in Senator Kubley's district, south of Milan, Minnesota. I started spraying in 1983, first time I ran a sprayer. That was 25 years ago. And I can tell you, and those of you that farm know, that when you sit and go up and down a field all day, 2-3 miles an hour, cultivating beets or corn, and a car drives by on the township road, that's kind of a highlight of your day. You know, you get to, oh, I wonder who that is then. And then they drive by in the township. If they stop, it's even more interesting for you. If we had kids that had stopped, that had driven by the field that I was working on, and the car stopped at the end of the field, and the mom said Johnny was driving by on his bike, and they think they might have got sprayed because he's got a rash, not only would I have her take me up to the shop where my pickup is, I'd drive the kid to the doctor myself. That's what would happen at our place. But that's good communication with neighbors. And I think that's lacking in some of the testimony. There's some problems in some areas. But that's what we would do. This bill is premised on neighbors not communicating, and they've had some problems, as they've indicated. But that's what we would do. And finally, I would make the point on the record disclosure. Senator Erickson Ropes and I visited about this morning. Where does the disclosure stop if we accept the argument that the public has a right to know what was sprayed on a cornfield? Keep in mind that that is a legal application of a legal product in a legal manner. If it drifts, as I mentioned earlier, that's a problem. If it stays on your field, it's fine. One of the reasons you spray at 5 in the morning is because it's calm. Many mornings I would get up at 4, and either my dad or I would drive the water truck, the other guy would drive the sprayer, and about 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, it starts to warm up. When it starts to warm up, earth heats, air rises, wind starts. Usually in the afternoon, you're not spraying. And then again after 6 p.m., that's another good time to spray because it's calm. It's one of the reasons why they're spraying at 5 a.m. But I was going to get to the point of limits. If they make the claim that they have a right to know what's going on in legal property, We talked about some of the known products, such as birth control pills and Prozac and antidepressants that are getting in the water. We had some testimony across the street last year, Environment Finance Committee, from a researcher who studied the water below Minneapolis, and they found shampoo and bug repellent and birth control pill residue and antidepressant drugs that the wastewater treatment plants aren't designed to pick up. So if I make that argument, and I live down in your area, down south of Minneapolis, and I want to protect my livestock from drinking out of a stream that might have birth control pill residue in it, do we have a right to know who's using that? Is that a road we want to go down? We could make that argument that we have the right to know that. We have the right to get into people's medicine cabinets to protect our livestock. So I'd have you consider that. Where are those limits of disclosure if you accept the premise that the public has a right to know? So, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Clavin. And let's have Mr. Stennis give his testimony, and then we'll go to questions.
Mr. Okay, Stennis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mark Stennis. I've been practicing commercial arboriculture and shade tree pathology since 1981. I've been working for tree services, basically. And given what
Mr. Clevin
here would just said, I was just about prepared to rest my case, but I represent a different client group, a different group of affected parties. I work now for S&S Tree Specialists, but I'm also here representing the interests and views of the Minnesota Turf and Grounds Foundation as its immediate past president. And the MTGF represents 8 affiliated professional green infrastructure maintenance industries in Minnesota. The one that I happen to belong to is the Minnesota Society of Arboriculture. It includes the cemeteries and the park superintendents and the school maintenance people in that group. Well, in addition to pruning and removals and other sweat and sawdust services that we provide, S&S also provides tree health care and maintenance services that sometimes involve the application of pesticides, for which a commercial pesticide application license is required by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Every applicator is required to have a license and must pass a rigorous exam that proves their competence with and knowledge of the products they use. I've had one since 1981. Extensive continuing education is required to remain certified and spray pesticides on your client's property. Detailed records are required for every application event and must be kept for a minimum of 5 years, and they are specified in great detail, I believe, in subsection 2. Is that it? And if that still applies, we've been keeping records like that for a long time. And everyone I know who is doing business legally is professionally responsible and supportive of these requirements. We don't have a problem with that. While I'm personally as liberal and environmentally green as anybody else in this room, I'm also professionally and on behalf of the MTGF opposed to Senate File 2994 being considered here today. In my view, this legislation is a tanker truck full of potentially explosive unintended consequences that we haven't been thinking very carefully about. Consider, for example, there are 2,500 to 3,000 crab apples. We work in ornamental things only. We do not apply any food product pesticide. But we spray between 2,500 and 3,000 ornamental crab apples, generally little trees, 2 to 3 times every spring just to keep the leaves from falling off in July so that there's something left on them at fair time. And we keep material safety data sheets, we keep records, detailed records for every application that we apply, and it's not just apple scab, but it's, I'm personally responsible for some of the technology that we use for the management of Dutch elm disease with systemic fungicides that never see the environment until they go right straight into the tree. But we keep records, even about wind speed. And all that stuff's important, and we don't have a problem with that. The problem is that if we're gonna take all these records, and we're talking thousands and thousands of records across the metro, wherever it is we work, someone's going to have to digitize them, collate them, and transfer them to the Department of Agriculture. And who is going to be at the Department of Agriculture to collect this stuff? Not just from S&S, but from Rainbow and from Top Notch and from Davy and from a Majestic Tree and yada, yada, yada. It goes on and on and on and on and on. And for what purpose? I mean, I don't understand what's to be gained by this mountain of data, which is basically impertinent to most issues. I mean, we are abiding by the law, and the laws are effective. And can be. There's always going to be somebody who doesn't obey the laws. And then, in my view, I think the financial burden is going to be huge, just not just for the applicator, but for the state and for what. Now, then there's one other little issue that really will affect us, possibly just put us out of this business entirely, and that's the requirement for a 48-hour notification. Now, we have all the challenge we have to notify the clients who hire us to provide fungicide sprays for their crabapple trees. But we have very narrow windows for the same reason that the agriculture interests have very narrow windows. It can't be windy. It can't be raining. It can't be a threat of it raining. So this window passes, and we need to apply the pesticides. And, you know, we're careful. We're not blowing rooster tails with toxic nerve gas over the biggest cottonwoods in the city. These pesticides are labeled, and we provide all the information anybody asks for. And who's going to tell that pine sawfly to wait for 2 days while we get permission from the neighbors? Because in the 2 days you're waiting, there won't be any needles left on that pine tree.
Yeah, Mr. Stennis, I think the A3 amendment resolved this issue that you're addressing.
Okay. That was brand new for me, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm
not. I think that's been addressed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I wasn't as prepared for that as I should have been.
Continue, Mr. Stennis.
While we do support doing the right thing to protect human health and environment and believe that as an industry we are professionally responsible in that regard, but we believe this bill will only succeed in being an unnecessary and costly burden on our industries, at least, without achieving its objectives. Accordingly, and without further elaboration, the Turf and Grounds Foundation and SNS Tree Specialists oppose the Senate file 2994.
Thank you. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to respond a little bit to what the two gentlemen had to say. First, I did want to point out there's a large difference between the Senate version of this bill and the House version. And that's where Mr. Clavin and I started having our conversation, and the Senate version is very different, and we've done a lot of negotiating and worked out a lot of compromise language. So I think some of the things that are making people extremely nervous about the House bill are not in this bill. I did want to
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm sorry. I'm not prepared as I could have been, but I was surprised by this.
Specifically,
Stennis, we understand that you didn't know about the amendment, but I just wanted to clarify that that had been addressed.
And I'd like to clarify, too, the 48-hour notification piece is out. You don't need permission from your neighbors, you know, and all that sort of thing.
That is a big difference.
One of the things that Mr. Clavin mentioned that I want to make sure that nobody misunderstands is that no one is blaming the Department of Agriculture about anything. I think that was one of the concerns you said that have been raised in the past, not within the purview of what we've been discussing, and not I have not ever said anything about the Department of Agriculture not doing their job. So I just want to be real clear, and I'm so glad that you have great communication in your family, Mr. Clavin. Your dad sounds like an awesome guy. I'd like to meet him. But not everybody communicates as well as you do, and so it brings us back to a central website that if people had an opportunity to go there, they'd be able to get some information. And again, members, I just want to remind you that we're still working on language on this bill. I'm willing to talk about, you know, we have emergency application provision in number 5. It says 24 hours. You know, we're willing to do some talking about that. I don't know if 24 hours is a reasonable amount of time for people to be able to respond. So we still have some discussion. And I would ask this committee, based on the fact that you know my style, and I hope you can trust me, you don't always agree, but you can trust that, you know, I'm going to say what I do, and that Mr. Clavin and I have been working really well together, that my hope is that you would pass this bill without recommendation to the next committee. It has to come back here to deal as the last stop. It starts and stops here. The ag finance piece is your purview as well. So even if I go to another committee, the bill comes back here, and you will have your chance to amend, unamend, add things on, stop the bill, lay it over. I mean, you have final control over this bill in the end. So I would ask members to consider passing this bill without recommendation to the next committee, and I can tell you that I will bring it back to this committee, and there'll be a final product, and then you can inspect that and support it or not support it at that time.
Well, Senator Erickson-Ropes, it's the Ag Policy Committee today, and I would hope that the Ag Policy is square and good as at least the committee. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to thank the two witnesses that were here earlier, too, to talk about the farm problems they had and so forth, and appreciate the testimony. In addition to having testimonials, though, it would be nice if one had some broad studies done that comprehensively measure, is this really a problem across the state of Minnesota? Now, in my own neighborhood and my own experience, I haven't really found that to be a problem. I know some legislators send out questionnaires to find out what their constituents really want, and some may send out like 18,000 copies of some questionnaire, and then they get 500 responses, and then they draw conclusions based on 500 responses. And that's interesting, but to me that's not a scientific analysis of public opinion. So for me to be convinced that we really need this, I need to see some comprehensive peer-reviewed study to show that there's all kinds of problems across the state and somehow this would solve it. And you've already mentioned about the good job the Department of Agriculture is doing, and that was confirmed by this study here, Pesticide Regulation, Office of the Legislative Auditor, done in 2006. And one of the conclusions they reached was the department, the Ag Department, has done a good job monitoring the use of agricultural pesticides and their effects on groundwater and surface water. So the legislative auditor, which we have a lot of respect for, that's the conclusion they came to. Now, this book is pretty interesting, and it's kind of encompasses some of the things I've often said in some of my speeches on this subject. But people are so bent out of shape over agricultural pesticides, and that word pesticide troubles them. But according to this chart and this auditor's report, 52% of all the pesticides used in the United States of America are for disinfecting water. Yeah. In other words, pesticides, we think of pesticides being bad, but they're really good. 52% disinfect water. Half of us are probably alive here today just because we've been disinfecting water. Only 14% of them are agricultural pesticides. 16% are for preserving wood. And I just think that I'm concerned when we try to perpetuate this myth that pesticides are bad for people and bad for society. Well, I know that Senator Erickson-Ropes, always get those two mixed up, was spent time in Tanzania just before she got to this legislative session. And boy, what a country. They need pesticides. Those poor people over there, and you told me this yourself, almost every patient you saw, your nurse, malaria. They need some pesticides to kill mosquitoes, control that protozoan parasite. And you talked about not feeling like you really wanted to walk barefoot out across the countryside because worms come out of the ground and go right through the sole of your feet.
That's right.
They need an anthelmintic. That's a pesticide to kill worms. And it just goes on and on. We've talked about the head lice problem and people with foot rot, or not foot rot, but athlete's foot, and they need to use fungicides. And thank God for toothpaste. I think we should quit talking about how bad pesticides are and try to balance it out a little bit by talking about how good they are. And one thing, that the wildlife of this state is so lucky that we have pesticides. Because with pesticides, we can produce so much product on fewer acres. We've got land left over for CRP and buffer strips along the ditches and rivers, and we can restore wetlands, and the wildlife population has exploded. Thank goodness for modern agriculture and the use of commercial fertilizers and pesticides. pesticides are good in so many ways. In the 3.5 years I spent in Vietnam, I suffered from enteric problems almost the whole time, and I needed more pesticides. I didn't probably use them as effectively as I could, but I was very darned happy when I found this French anthelmintic that finally cleared things up for me. So anyway, you've done a great job working with people and working with talking to me about it and talking to Clavin and talking to all kinds of people. You've been doing a great job that way, but I just am reticent to pass a bill out that perpetuates a myth that pesticides are so bad. And one final point. We always think about pesticides as being some kind of a man-made product. Bad, bad, bad. But most of the pesticides in this world are natural pesticides that have evolved as part of the plant. They protect that plant from its environment. There's all kinds of fungi out there and viruses, and the plant has developed a resistance and a mechanism, and they've got antiviral products right within their plant matrix to protect them. And according to some people, almost 90%, 98% of all the pesticides in this world are natural pesticides that evolved, that the Lord has created to protect the plants and animals on this earth. And it's, I think we should all thank our lucky stars that we've got pesticides. Otherwise, half of us would be dead by now.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Dill. I have also used the natural pesticides around my house. I think I've actually put down sprigs of sage and artemisia in front of my doorstep, which is what they used to do, in the 1700s to keep the ants out. And to your point earlier, Senator, about the barber, giving you medications, I think back in the Middle Ages, barbers were the healthcare providers. They give you a haircut. Cut and bleed you at the same time. Literally, really. But I would agree with you, Senator, about the pesticide need in Tanzania, and I would also go so far to say that Tanzanians have a right to know what those pesticides are. So I think there's a lot of things that we do have in common and understand together. I want to make the point, though, of saying that I am not saying here that pesticides are bad. I'm saying that the public has a right to know what's being applied.
Senator Chaudhry.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Dill, I'm wondering if this myth about pesticides gets perpetuated because we don't know enough about them and that there isn't information about it. There's an analogy that I can think of. I remember the Senate was debating whether we should put video cameras in police cars, because we wanted to crack down on racial profiling. And so we put a bunch of video cameras in police cars, and what it turns out to do is its primary effect has been is not to nab abusers in the criminal justice system. But what it's actually ended up doing is absolving police officers who have been accused of abuse. So it's had kind of that almost opposite effect. But there was this myth that was being perpetuated by anecdotes and accusations that there was a lot more, perhaps, racial profiling that was going on than was actually the case. So I'm wondering if getting more information out about pesticides would help dispel the myths that you're talking about and actually prove what chemicals are bad and, indeed, what chemicals are good. It seems to me that, at the very least, we should be allowing information about pesticides for the use of medical treatment. And what it might actually end up doing is teaching us about what doesn't harm people or animals. People that come forward and say, well, I'm sick, it must be this pesticide. If we knew what was being used, what was being delivered and applied, we would have better information, just as much information as to what isn't harming people as to what might be. Don't you think that's a fair assessment?
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Chaudhary, I think that research and continuing to expand our knowledge base is a great idea, because we learn a lot of things as we do research, and in order to really confirm that something's true, it really needs to be done in multiple settings and multiple researchers and peer-reviewed setting and so on. Now, I've also given speeches about how everything's toxic, because it's the dose that makes the poison. So even though we talk about pesticides being good, they have to be used according to the label and not overused, and the dose makes the poison. So the coffee that's in front of you, the caffeine that's in that cup, if you took the caffeine out and measured at least the acute toxicity of caffeine, it comes out to 200 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. That will kill 50% of the rats. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take the atrazine, which many people are worried about, and measure the LD50 on that, it takes about 3,000 milligrams of atrazine to kill half the rats. In other words, that coffee that you're drinking there is about 15 times more toxic than atrazine. And it just happens that table salt has an LD50 of 3,000 also, so atrazine and table salt have a similar LD50, so it's about the same. If you put salt in your food, just remember that that's as toxic as atrazine. So there's lots of things to learn, but it's the dose that makes the poison. And it's, but I'm in favor of research and expanding your knowledge base, and I don't know what is your point that we should be letting everybody know what's going on everywhere, including... When I come to your house tomorrow night, if I come, do I need to let you know that I treated my athlete's foot with some kind of fungicide before I show up?
Mr. Chair, just very
Senator Chaudhary.
Just very quickly, I would be able to read on any athlete's foot product what is in that. So if I knew that you were using it, I wouldn't have to ask. It would be public information. And so that's, I think that's the point. I mean, the myths that you seek to dispel, atrazine, caffeine, wouldn't it help your point if that information was public so we could dispel those myths?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Dill,
Senator Chaudhary, I've got a handout right here.
Comment. Senator Dill.
Well, this is a handout on atrazine and the health risk limits and LD50s and one thing or another that anybody, there's copies here if somebody wants to know. I think that's a good idea. Let's educate people about the benefits of all kinds of things, including pesticides. I'm just glad we got fluorine in the water here, and it keeps our teeth in good shape and kills bacteria, and we flush the toilet here at the Capitol, and we know it's well taken care of.
Before we go to Senator Erickson Ropes, is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 2994? Seeing none, Senator Erickson Ropes, we know there is a fiscal impact for that, and we do have people here that would testify on that, but we're not going to bring them up because the Judiciary Committee has asked for this, and so you'll have to comprehend, figure out what you're going to do with that in your motion. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I really appreciate all the discussions going on here. I'd remind this committee, this is not a bill about research. It's not a bill about dosages or drift. We've got great laws on the books about drift. This is only a bill about creating a website and posting information on applications. So, now, Mr. Chair, I have a question. As a rookie, I don't want this bill to get killed today. So it seems I'm taking a risk at asking the committee to pass it without recommendation to the next committee, because you could all vote no and that would kill my bill. Is that correct?
That would be correct, sir. Senator Erickson-Rolfe.
Then I would just ask this committee again to judge on the good faith effort that I have put forward and my continued pledge to work with the stakeholders, Mr. Clavin and Mr. Stennis, you know, if he would like to do that. The bill has to come back to Ag for the finance piece. And if you feel compelled to vote no, I'd ask you to consider putting that off for another day and allowing this bill to move forward and return back to this committee for the finance piece.
Thank you. We need a motion, Senator Erickson.
I would move to move Senate File 2994 as amended to go forward to the Judiciary Committee without recommendation.
Senator Erickson-Ropes moves Senate File 2994 as amended to go without recommendation to the Judiciary Committee. Any more discussion, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say same sign.
Aye.
Aye.
Nays have it. The motion does not prevail. The bill is not passed.
Have a division.
Division is called for. All those in favor, raise their hands. All those opposed, raise your hands. The nays have it. The bill is not passed. There's no further work in front of the committee. Committee's adjourned.
Yeah.